From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, happy new year, but on this show, we're going to look back at 2025. We'll recap the year that was in Illinois government and politics. That's coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest, it's always good to have her back with us, Hannah Meisel, reporter with Capital News Illinois. It's been a busy year for Hannah. Hannah, thanks for taking time to join us on the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Sean.
Some years we do this show, and we always do this year-end wrap-up. It's like there was one or two things maybe to talk about. You know, sometimes we have to really look back in the archives. Really no problems this year, because there was quite a list of things that occurred. And we won't probably get to everything on this show, but when I look back at 2025, what stands out to me was Donald Trump taking office, not just at the federal level, but also what it meant here in the state of Illinois. And one of the things that it meant was immigration enforcement really ramping up. We saw ICE agents out on the streets more, the Border Patrol even tried to get the National Guard.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Donald Trump's effect on Illinois can't be overstated. It's changed the political calculation of so many things, not just immigration, but I think we'll later talk about the effect on Illinois' budget, the effect on Illinois' energy and climate goals, manufacturing too. The most visible, I definitely agree with you, is this Operation Midway Blitz, which began in September and included sending in U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, which is, you know, highly unusual because usually Border Patrol actually lives at the southern U.S. border. They have a different kind of mindset when it comes to immigration enforcement versus ICE agents who are, you know, who have been for almost 20 years since it was established, embedded in cities. And so you saw much more aggressive tactics from Border Patrol, and Commander Greg Bovino, who was the face of Operation Midway Blitz. And so from mid-September to mid-November, this, you know, kind of two-month, very aggressive immigration enforcement campaign went on, and we still don't have final numbers from the Department of Homeland Security. The last numbers we have, which are, you know, pretty outdated at this point, from, I want to say, mid-October, was about 3,000 people arrested, but we know that that number is actually much higher. Included in those arrests were people who are U.S. citizens, people who are actually here. They might not be citizens, but they're here in this country legally. Of course, you also have people who are in this country without papers. Unlike decades of precedent, you had people being targeted who had been in the U.S. for years and years, who have businesses, who, you know, pay taxes. Contrary to the Trump administration's constant refrain that they're targeting the, quote, worst of the worst, you know, you had a lot of people who, you know, are just trying to get by in this country. And not to mention, I mean, it was not 2 years ago, in really 2023, when you had governors like Texas Governor Greg Abbott, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, busing and flying people, especially Venezuelan immigrants, but not just people from Venezuela, people who had crossed the southern border during the Biden years when the border was, you know, more open than it had been before. And, you know, they were being bused and flown to so-called sanctuary cities, including Chicago. These are now the same people who are being targeted. We saw an example of that, I believe it was in late September, when Border Patrol raided an apartment complex in Chicago's South Shore neighborhood. The official line was that Border Patrol was looking for people in this Venezuelan gang, but the entire apartment complex, people were taken out in zip ties, included babies in the middle of the night. Some people were, not dressed for the weather, not dressed at all. And the apartment complex was left a complete mess. And in recent weeks, it's been like basically condemned, and people can't, go back there. And this includes, of course, those Venezuelan immigrants, but it also includes US citizens. That's just one example. We had, tons of lawsuit. I was in and out of federal court a lot this fall because there was so much litigation that came out of this federal immigration enforcement campaign. You had Greg Bovino brought into court, questioned about agents' use of force, including so-called riot control weapons, including like tear gas. And you had the judge in that case, register that he had lied in his deposition. And, she said that in her delivering her preliminary injunction, which of course is now kind of moot as after the case moved to the Seventh Circuit, the plaintiffs there kind of saw the writing on the wall and moved to actually dismiss the case. And there's a lot of unanswered questions. Greg Bovino and Border Patrol agents were back in Chicago for a quick couple of days. They're gone now, according to reporting from the Chicago Tribune. But earlier reporting this fall indicated that they intend to be back in March, and they could be back, basically fivefold in the number of people, the agents they bring.
And certainly something to watch as we go into the new year. Charlie, it's hard to believe that this has really only been going on since around the start of the fall, because it has really changed so many parts of the city. As people in certain communities in Chicago and Chicago area, afraid to go to work, afraid to go to community events, some cases even afraid to go to school.
Yeah, and it's going to get worse, as Hannah said. Five times as many of the people flooding Chicago as there were at the end of the fall when they took off and headed to North Carolina and then headed to Louisiana. But it struck me that this whole thing is really not about getting, quote, the worst of the worst. It's all performance, it's all performative art. And Hannah mentioned the raid on that apartment in South Shore. Well, they had helicopters with people rappelling down into the roof, all this kind of stuff busting in the doors. And they had camera crews that were recording it. And when Bovino and his guys first arrived, and they're walking down Michigan Avenue in their full camo gear and with the face masks and everything, and they're posing by the bean, immigration deportations have been going on for a long time. The difference is they were done properly and not just rounding up a number of people. Anybody who had brown skin would get rounded up, or anybody who was not speaking English. I know there was one instance where a woman, and I don't know what her name was, but it was an Irish sounding name. Maybe it was something like O'Connell or something like that. And the agent said, "Well, you don't look like an O'Connell." And she was a US citizen. And he pulled her in. And as a matter of fact, the Trib did an analysis, and I think it came out in December, and they concluded of, and this is a quote from the story, of the 1,895 people detained by ICE, 1,271 lacked any criminal record. Another 340 people arrested had a pending criminal charge, while 281 had a criminal conviction. Of those with a criminal conviction, the vast majority of offenses were misdemeanors, traffic citations, or nonviolent felonies. Only 28 arrestees, 1.5%, have been convicted of a violent felony or sex crime. And I'm not sure where it's going to lead to, but I think it was just a total disaster. And it strikes fear into these communities. As Sean said, people afraid to take their kids to school. They, in some of the neighborhoods, they arranged like a walking school bus where people who were documented would go and pick up kids from the homes of folks who didn't have documentation and take them to school. As I say, I don't know where it's going to go. One of the things that happened that I thought was interesting was we actually created an accountability commission that Pritzker set up, to basically to review and document misconduct of federal immigration agents in Chicago. And they had their first hearing in December. They heard from people who were victimized. They heard from experts in medicine and in policing. Now, the federal people say, well, no, we can do whatever we want. We're the federal government, so screw you. But the point is they're putting together information that perhaps could be used to prosecute agents who were accused of misconduct. There'll be some kind of official record of it.
Well, also the Trump administration policies, things like money for education, also money for health care, all of these things really having a big impact on states, not just Illinois, but certainly Illinois. And it comes at a time, Hannah, where Illinois is also seeing the end of all of that pandemic money that helped a lot, helped get things, the ship righted over the last several years. But this really puts a lot of uncertainty on the state's budget and Governor J.B. Pritzker especially.
It was the first kind of real tough budget year in a while. Obviously, 2020 was a very tough budget year because that May, when the budget was being put together, it was really just in the first few months of the pandemic. But then, of course, the economy recovered like remarkably quickly in the next year or so, and you know, continued to ride out a fairly strong, unexpectedly strong economy, in part due to that federal money that was being poured in many different forms, including you know, stimulus to consumers who then, you know, spent that money. And in addition to the strength of income taxes, not just from individuals, but also corporations. But this is really the first budget year in a while, and you know, frankly, in Pritzker's tenure as governor, that has been like truly, truly difficult, because it's not just, unlike the pandemic, where there was, you know, of course, there's a ton of uncertainty, but there was a hope that things could recover, and we didn't know that we could recover so quickly. This is more of a long-term fear, because we have a lot more fears of long-term damage to the economy, you know, anything from the threats to manufacturing because of these tariffs pushed by the president, to costs of anything from insurance, but also things like energy. I mean, in 2021, I watched very closely the legislature, you know, pass, you know, it was really a multi-year effort that culminated in 2021, but pass CEJA, the big energy bill, you know, these major energy reforms. Illinois for a long time had been known as a low-cost energy state, and, you know, manufacturers especially, because of course, manufacturing plants use up a tremendous amount of energy. We did see some warnings, you know, back in 2021. But one of the big things that we could not have predicted is this absolute explosion in artificial intelligence and the amount of energy that these data centers that are used to power AI use up. I mean, we were talking a little before the show, Charlie and I had seen the same report that one of these planned data centers would use up more energy than is used by New York City. The effect of the Trump administration, Medicaid is a huge, huge part of state budget. It's a, you know, huge pass-through line item, and cuts in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, the you know, basically the Trump led budget that was passed by Congress this summer. Huge coming cuts to Medicaid to plan for the future. It makes it really, really hard.
As Hannah said, it was a very difficult year for Governor Pritzker, his Bureau of the Budget, and the legislature to come up with a budget. They finally did, and they put some safeguards in there. One of the things they did was that they created a flexible fund of $100 million that the governor can use to cover gaps left by unrealized federal funding. And it takes money from about 50 or so existing funds that weren't being fully used. And so this is in there, this flexible fund. And the governor, at the beginning of the fall, issued an executive order to require state agencies to identify spending reductions and create reserves. They were told to reserve 4% of their general fund appropriations. So that could halt up to roughly $2.2 billion in approved spending. And that's, I guess, what you would say, being cautious about what might happen. And then there was a report that came out right at the beginning of December by the Illinois Economic Policy Institute, and it found that federal budget cuts could reduce the size of Illinois' economy by nearly $10 billion a year. And the authors looked at some of the impacts, things like the changes in Medicaid that Hannah referred to, phasing out the energy credits, the impact of the tariffs, cuts to education. I guess the argument is that even though the federal constitution gives the power of the purse to the legislature, to Congress, that he's the governor, he's the president, and he can do whatever he wants because he's the president. And so that, a lot of that stuff has been challenged by attorneys general, including Kwame Moreau here in Illinois, and it's working its way up to the Supreme Court.
Well, Charlie, also energy, as was mentioned there, certainly playing a big role. Just ask anybody who got a big bump in their electric bills over the summer from Ameren, Commonwealth Edison.
Yeah, there was an analysis that came out in mid-December that showing that demand is sky high and older sources of power, such as coal plants, are shutting down. Newer sources of clean power, like wind and solar, aren't coming online quickly enough. State Senator Bill Cunningham, who's a Democrat from Chicago and who has been a point person on clean energy legislation, said, and here's a quote, "The upshot is the energy transition in Illinois is likely to be more gradual and more reliant on natural gas plants than previously thought. We tried to expect the unexpected," he said. "The unexpected turned out to be data centers." And this report said that the state can add electricity by building battery storage, improve transmission lines to help better connect new sources of power, conserve energy, and make additional use of the nuclear power plants that are here in Illinois. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, has cut a deal with the Clinton nuclear power plant. That nuclear plant will supply the power needed for Meta's data center. And they're also talking about maybe expanding to add another reactor down in Clinton. I guess this is a warning that we have to start taking this stuff seriously. We did pass a sweeping energy reform package. In fact, this will be enacted. And it's an energy policy package intended to incentivize battery storage. It lifts a longtime ban on new nuclear power developments and gives new authority to the regulatory agencies. The main feature is this incentive structure for energy storage projects. One of the raps that you've heard about relying on solar energy or wind power is that, well, the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. And that's obviously true, but the notion is that you create these huge batteries that when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing, the energy that's generated can be stored in the batteries. One of the things that wasn't in there, which we referred to earlier, there's no attempt to kind of regulate the data centers. That was discussed, but it did not make it into the final package.
Well, let me also mention the governor signing off, lawmakers approving this year, a couple of other big pieces of legislation. And we've talked about them on the show, but I'll mention them again just so people remember this happened. But the transit legislation that prevents that fiscal cliff from happening in the Chicago area and also the service cuts that could have come along with that, that was approved. And also something called medical aid in dying. It allows a terminally ill person to request a prescription from a doctor who would basically write a prescription for medication that would end that person's life or assisted suicide, some like to call it. But that was also a monumental piece of legislation that'll take effect later in 2026. Want to save a little bit of time here at the end, though, to also talk about a couple of other key stories that took place this year. And one of these, which might have been the top story in most years, was the fact that Michael Madigan, former Illinois House Speaker, longtime Democratic power broker in the state of Illinois, he'd been on trial and early this year was convicted of corruption, later sentenced to prison, and he's now serving time in a federal prison in West Virginia. And Hannah, you covered this trial. Not something I think if I'd have looked ahead 10 years ago and this was how Michael Madigan's career was going to end, I would have been stunned by that, but here we are.
Yeah, no, I mean, I often think about how I first came to Springfield and I saw, you know, Madigan kind of at the peak of his power, you know, when he was at loggerheads with, you know, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner from 2015 to 2017 during the 2-year budget impasse. You know, then Madigan, I would say you could say that he won that fight. But then pretty quickly after that, Madigan was accused of mishandling accusations of sexual harassment in both his political and government operations. And, you know, the hits just kept on coming. And in 2019, then the slow drip, that there was a pretty intense FBI investigation into his inner circle. And of course, in 2020, his allies were indicted, and it was just a matter of time until his own indictment in early 2022. But, you know, I want to mention that it was a huge shock when in January, as the trial was winding down, Madigan decided to take the stand. And he spent a very intense, I believe it was 4 days on the witness stand, which opened him up to very, very intense cross-examination from the lead prosecutor. And then in February, after 2 weeks of jury deliberation, he was found guilty on 10 of the 23 counts. The jury deadlocked on 6 counts, and then they dismissed another 7. Like you said, Madigan has been spending time in a West Virginia prison since he reported there, I believe it was the beginning of October. And, you know, I think that next year will bring more news about his plan, his appeal, which has already started. He hired some pretty high profile appellate lawyers to handle that. And we'll see where it goes. But like you said, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, no doubt. And he was also, as we mentioned, was found guilty back in February, around the same time that the new president at the time, taking over for a second term, Donald Trump, then gave a pardon and the eventual release to Rod Blagojevich from federal prison. And of course, Madigan oversaw Blagojevich's impeachment and removal from office. Charlie, just real quick, your thoughts on Madigan.
Well, as I've said many times, I think Michael Madigan is someone who was played by the rules as they existed when he started in politics, and the rules changed, and he did not adapt to them. I have said this before, and I'll say it again. I think on balance, Michael Madigan was good for the state of Illinois. Hannah alluded to his resistance to Bruce Rauner's attempt to basically hold the state hostage, and I think Madigan helped usher through things that a young Mike Madigan at ConCon back in 69-70 would never imagine, things like gay marriage, for example. And so I think on balance, as I say, the times changed and he didn't, and now he's in West Virginia, and there was a motion filed or papers filed asking for clemency. And that was again last month in December, saying, and this was on file at the office of the pardon attorney, the petition asks for pardon after completion of sentence. And as we were discussing before the show, nobody really knows what the heck that means. The clemency, we don't know how that's going to turn out, but the three Republican members of Congress have urged, from Illinois, have urged the president not to use his pardon powers to grant clemency to Madigan. And what they wrote, they said, if he were to pardon Madigan, it would send a, quote, would send a dangerous message that public officials can betray the public trust with impunity. That was Mike Boss, Darren LaHood, Mary Miller wrote that in a letter to Trump.
Charlie, I'll let you weigh in on this, but we also lost two former governors, George Ryan and also Jim Edgar, both passing away here in 2025. So just a real quick remembrance of them.
Well, they were both downstaters, for starters. Ryan, of course, was from Kankakee. Edgar was from Charleston. The difference to me was George was a politician. I've said this before. Had he been brought up in Chicago, he would have been a daily Democrat. He wasn't really into the ins and outs of policy, but on the other hand, he was someone who was a very thoughtful, very considerate individual. One of the major things that he did as governor, he allowed an execution to go forward of an individual who was clearly guilty, but it still bothered him. And he basically placed a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois. And then later it was, we repealed that law. And he was willing to step out of, what would you say, to try and do things to help people. Jim Edgar, on the other hand, he was also a very considerate individual, but he was someone who was more of a policy wonk. And he really liked getting into the nitty-gritty of things. He started as a state lawmaker, and then he was on the staff of the governor. And he served as Secretary of State and then became elected governor himself. But he was a very thoughtful, he was very prim and proper. And I guess that's what I'd say, very prim and proper. And he probably made a greater contribution than any of his predecessors for the public policy betterment of the state of Illinois when he created a program called the Edgar Fellows, which provides training, leadership training, public policy training for individuals who are starting out their career in state or local government. And it's bipartisan. And they have meetings throughout the course of a year where they will look at issues and try and find common ground. And that was something that that Edgar was. He was not at all a belligerent troublemaker, as his successor, Rod Blagojevich, was, or as Bruce Rauner was. He was somebody who tried to get things done, very low-key and very well-respected. And so from my perspective, and I've watched both George Ryan and Jim Edgar from the very first entry they had into public life, they were very, very, they were different personalities, but they were good people in my judgment.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That is our year in review for our State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.